So, Red, are you originally from Charleston?
Born and raised here. Born in Baker Hospital, 1932. And I've been here pretty much most of my life. Spent about 15 years in Washington. But by and large, I've been right here in Charleston.
How'd you get involved in radio?
When I was going to the College of Charleston, a friend of mine was a weekend disc jockey at WTMA. And he had to go into service. He was drafted. So he sort of turned the job over to me. And I had to get rid of my Charleston brogue to take the job. But I did. And stayed in broadcasting after that, although I was studying chemistry and math at the College of Charleston at the time.
So WTMA was the first station you worked for?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And what year would this be?
1953 or 4. I think that's right.
Okay, what was WTMA doing on the air at that time?
They were playing pop music. They were a so-called Top 40 station.
I don't think it was called Top 40 at that time, but...
Well, yeah, Top 40, and they were playing the so-called good music, sort of a mixture of Top 40 and good music. They had a rhythm and blues show on at night, late at night at 11 o'clock, with Jack Gale, called the Hound Dog Show.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But by and large, they were a Top 40 station.
And who else was working there when you started?
Bill Walton, Jack Gale. I think Bill Evenson was working there when I first went there. Of course, I was only working on the weekend, and I was a college kid. I mean, I couldn't find my rear end with both hands around a radio station. But Bill Walton taught me pretty much everything I needed to learn in terms of cleaning up my voice, getting rid of the Charleston accent, and so forth and so on.
So what was radio like there from a technical standpoint? I guess that was before the tape era when you started?
Yeah, all of the commercials were on disc. We were using some reel-to-reel tape at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Not much, but some. But most all of the commercials were on disc, and otherwise they were read live, including old Red with his heavy Charleston brogue. I was pretty bad. I can tell you that.
So how long were you at WTMA?
Well, at that time, I worked there a year, finished school, then went to work at a radio station in Beaufort, South Carolina. That was my first full-time broadcast job. It didn't last but about a month. That was the first broadcast job I got. Then I went to Tallahassee, Florida, and spent 3 years down there at a radio station. I did the night show. We had four radio stations on the air. I'm very proud to say that three of them shared 15% of the audience, and I had the other 85%.
Wow.
On a night show in a drive-in restaurant called the Dixieland Drive-In, and it was fun.
Speaking of big ratings at that time, WTMA was...
They were the hottest station probably in South Carolina, I'm sure of it.
Makes you wonder why nobody else was trying to do Top 40 radio at the time.
Well, WTMA was innovative back then. The Jack Gale Show at 11 o'clock was very innovative. I mean, it was rhythm and blues of the, back then would have been called the most gross in the world. I mean,
race
really
music,
was.
Right?
Yes. I mean, it was the whole nine yards. And of course, Jack Gale was white. He was a hot jock. He really was. He had the audience.
When did you come back to WTMA?
Well, let's see. I spent 3 years in Tallahassee. I came back to Charleston, worked at WOKE for a couple of years, Wonderful Woke Radio, with Harry Weaver, at which time I recorded that promo he used for the next 25 years. In fact, when I came back to Charleston in 1993, they were still using it. It was a recording that went, "This is Wonderful Woke Radio, Charleston's number two radio station. We must be number two. All the others are number one."
Oh, I must have heard that 100 times.
Yeah, I'm telling you. And I recorded that back then. So anyway, I worked there for about 3 years, then went to Spartanburg, South Carolina, worked up there 4 or 5 years, came back. Let's see, when I came back from Spartanburg, I went to work at WTMA then. That was when I came back to WTMA. And, of course, I was full-time then. And I did a drive-in show in the old Target drive-in for Joe Lebelski.
Which was where?
On Rivers Avenue, just above Remount. Anyway, I did that show for a number of years at TMA.
Was that every night?
Yes, 5 days a week. It was a drive-in show. We had a glassed-in booth over the parking lot, and I could sit up there and play the records and carry on. We took requests and the whole thing.
So you actually played the music from the drive-in?
Yes, played it from the drive-in.
Commercials as well?
Commercials and all.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I had my own stack of cartridges. Had to carry them out there and load them up, what have you, while I was playing the music. And I used to pantomime the record. My favorite was Marty Robbins' El Paso. That was a lot of fun. For a young guy, doing a drive-in DJ show is absolutely more fun than anything you can think of. You know, the girls are there and everybody's having a grand time. I'll tell you a quick story about the days in Tallahassee. We didn't have this happen in Charleston, unfortunately, but it snowed one time in Tallahassee, Florida. Well, now, snow is not as rare as you might think, but in Tallahassee, Florida, 8 inches of snow is the rarest kind. The town went bananas. I mean, they just went crazy. So I was on the air at the drive-in, the Dixieland drive-in, and I thought, let's have a promotion here. And I just dreamed this up off the top of my head and said I would give a couple of record albums, and I couldn't tell you what the albums were, to whoever brought the biggest snowman to the drive-in restaurant. Believe it or not, it captured the imagination of Tallahassee, Florida. Now, why, I don't know, but people started driving into that drive-in restaurant with a snowman on top of their cars and their trucks, and it got so bad the highway patrol had to come out and control traffic on Monroe Street, which was right in front of the drive-in, and everything else like that. And the winner was a fraternity from Florida State University, from FSU, that drove in with a Ford station wagon with a 10-foot snowman on the back combined with the tailgate. And it weighed so much they had almost the entire fraternity brothers sitting on the hood to hold the front end of the car down while they drove that snowman to the Dixieland drive-in.
Wow.
I mean, it was wild. It was just wild.
All for just a couple of record albums.
All for a couple of record albums. We had a scavenger hunt once, and one of the items was a goat. I said, whoever brings a billy goat. I was just cutting up. I mean, I was crazy. I was a wild man. They call me the rockin' redhead. Well, people started showing up with everything but the goat. And I started saying, now, wait a minute. You know, I'm not going to give this prize, which was no more than a record album, to anybody unless they got the goat. There again, it captured the imagination of the town. And, of course, that was a Florida State town. So, you know, there was a lot of young people. To make a long story short, I stayed on the air until 1 o'clock because we got a call from a fraternity that they had a goat and they were bringing it to the drive-in. And once again, people went crazy. They came to the drive-in to see these kids bring a goat. I mean, that was all. They were just going to bring a goat, a billy goat. And they did. And once again, they had to get traffic control and everything else because the drive-in was swamped. I mean, just swamped. All to come see a billy goat.
How had radio changed from the time that you originally worked at WTMA to the second time you worked there?
One thing that had changed by then, we were starting to see the use of cartridges instead of disc recording.
The second time that you were at TMA, who were some of the voices and personnel at the time?
You know, I don't remember them.
Because you were out at the drive-in.
Yeah, I knew them. I don't mean to suggest that I was stuck up or anything like that. I just didn't come in contact with many of the other on-air personnel. Didn't do many commercials for TMA back then. Later, when I was at Woke and other stations, I did a lot of commercials, a lot of productions stuff that.
Mm-hmm.
Did a lot for Woke. I left TMA then, went back to Woke, as a matter of fact, and worked there for maybe 2 years, I guess. I guess I sort of outgrew popular music, top 40 music or whatever it is. I'm not sure.
So at that time, WOKE was playing popular music, top 40 music. They weren't playing the old fogey music that they
That's right.
Came
Wonderful
to play later.
Woke Radio decided they would try to compete with TMA. And they did a fairly decent job of it. They really didn't have the power to knock TMA off in terms of the number one radio station in Charleston. But they did a pretty good job. Anyway, I guess I got tired of that music and decided I wanted to do something more. And I went to work for WNCG Radio and set up the first radio news department in Charleston.
And WNCG is 910.
That's correct. This station that is now WTMZ was WNCG.
That would be around 1960, I know, when the station came on the air. Was that about the time
you
were
that
over
was
there?
1963, I think, or two, something like that, that I started that news department. I told Ansley Cohen, the then owner of NCG, that I could set up a live news operation with a news car, two-way radios, and a lot of time. So that's what we did.
So before that time, there was really no local radio news in Charleston?
No, all the news on radio in Charleston back then was rip and read.
Straight off the Associated Press and UPI wire machines?
That's correct.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Even the local stuff?
That's correct. If it didn't appear on the teletype, it wasn't going to be read on radio in Charleston. No one was doing that, to my knowledge, unless something really big required it. But otherwise,
so nobody was bothering to pick up the paper and rewrite the local stories?
No. That's one of the things I did at NCG. I did take some stories from the newspaper, but by and large, anything they covered, I was covering live. I was there and chasing it, digging it out. I had news rounds. I went to people that and told them, look, I'm a newsman in Charleston. I need to know what's going on. Will you tell me? And they were kind enough to do so. And I competed with the newspaper. I whipped them, too, a number of times. They'll admit that.
Just as WTMA is whipping them nowadays sometimes.
I think so, yeah.
So how long were you at WNCG?
Only 3 years, and then I left them and went to work for Senator Fritz Hollings and worked for him for a couple of years as his what they called home secretary. And then Channel 2 lost their news director, Ed Webb, And they came to me and asked me if I'd come to work for them as their news director. So that's how I ended up in television. And that's where I stayed for the next 12 years.
What was WNCG doing music-wise when you were doing the news there?
Good music.
What WTMZ is doing today.
That's right. Yeah,
it's come full circle.
Yeah, that's right.
Did you notice that any of the other radio stations, because you were doing news at WNCG, decided, hey, this might be a good idea to actually...
Three of them, including WTMA.
Get a local news department?
They got a local news department. One of their news directors is still a very good friend of mine, Wayne Long. He went to work for the country music station, and I'm sorry, I can't recall those call letters.
WQSN?
QSN, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He was a news director over there. And then he worked for me at Channel 2 for a little while, doing my 11 o'clock news. All the radio stations tried to compete. I say all three, the three bigger stations, TMA, NCG, and WCSC Radio, tried to compete with me. But Wayne did a pretty good job staying with me. The rest never really caught up, because we really had a big jump on them.
You would think that WCSC Radio, since they had a TV station there, would have had the advantage, since they had the TV news department to pull from.
Well, you'd think so, but their approach to news was different from mine. My approach was that my community is listening to me, and this was true in radio and it was true in television. My community is listening to me and depending on me to tell them what happened today, what's going on in their community. Good, bad, or indifferent didn't matter. I was going to tell them. If they liked it, fine. If they didn't like it, that's all right, too. But they're going to know it. I'm going to tell them.
What was a typical day like for you at WNCG when you were a news person?
Started at 5 o'clock in the morning. I did a 7 o'clock news, and then I hustled downtown and started making rounds. Would go to the police stations, all three of them, city, county, and state. And I would go by political contacts I had, people on the waterfront, business leaders, political leaders, people I knew, and people who had a little faith in me that I would not divulge where, you know, who told me about it. And I would dig it out. I'd find out what was going on, whether it was going to be reported in a press release or not. I was going to find it out first. On NCG, and we're talking radio here, so we'll leave television out of it. I was only one man. So my responsibility was to find enough people who would talk to me and tell me what's going on so that I didn't have to try to be everywhere. I had to have people who had enough faith in me, like me enough, maybe, to call me and say, hey, Red, did you know so-and-so? That's how I got my news. And
did you take a tape recorder out in the field and tape
yes.
voices and
record
things off the telephone?
Mm-hmm. I did, and I reported from the scene all the time. That really was the key, was to be on the scene. This was, you know, breaking news, major events. I was on scene, did it live, pure ad lib. Of course, I had a scheduled newscast at 12 o'clock and a scheduled newscast at 6 o'clock. Both of those were 15-minute newscasts, which doesn't sound like much time, but it's an awful lot of time when you've got to get there, get to the radio station early enough to type it up, to read it, and, you know, have it ready by 6 o'clock. So, you know, I'd be on the street as long as I could, and then I would get to the radio station, type the news up, and then get on the air and report it.
So you had a pretty full day.
Yeah, it was a full day, but I loved it. My God, it was more fun. You can't imagine. You were where the action was, when the action was. It was exciting, sometimes dangerous, but it was always fun.
Going back to WTMA, what was a typical day like for you the second time you worked at WTMA, the drive-in thing?
Come in the afternoon, get the music ready, pull out whatever commercials I was going to use. Then I headed for the Target. It seems to me I had to be there at 6 o'clock. And then I went on the air, I think, like 7, but I'm not sure. Stayed on the air till midnight.
Was WTMA a 24-hour station then?
No.
They signed off the air at midnight?
They signed off. They were licensed to stay on, but they did not.
Let's ask about the music at WTMA at the time. Since we don't have any tapes from that era, was all the music during the day, maybe in the 50s, was it all white artists? Did they try not to play any black artists, or did they mix those in?
There was never any avoidance of black artists or white artists. If a record was a hit, it was a hit. It didn't make any difference. Didn't make a particle bit of difference.
So you were on the radio when Elvis hit, huh?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
What was that like?
Well, you couldn't play enough of him, I can tell you that. The adults sort of, you know, they had a big thing about the wiggling hips and all of that sort of thing, but the young people, they wanted to hear Elvis. And Pat Boone and all that crap. Fats Domino was hot. You could not play Fats Domino walking to New Orleans often enough. I mean, they just loved it. There was never any deliberate effort to avoid black artists. In fact, as they produced more and more records that were hits, we played them. Didn't make a difference to us. It's what the kids wanted to hear, and so we were going to play them.
When you were a DJ, would you decide what songs to play?
Yeah. We have, our records were 45s, you know, the 45 RPM records. This is kind of cute. I learned to be an expert on the color of the label because you could have a stack of 50 or 75 45 RPM records in front of you. If you kinked them to the side and looked down through the hole in the 45 RPM record, you could see the colors that you wanted. And if it was a Columbia record, which back then was yellow, you could look down in all the yellow records, you could flip to see if that's the one you wanted. How you found the record. So I got pretty good about knowing what color that label was going to be. So Fats Domino was on Dot Records, and it was a black label. So I could look down through that hole and see the label.
Today, you have a program director at radio station that tells the disc jockey what to play and when to play it. What was the program director's job back then? If you got a
basically
chance to pick out
thing.
The same music?
Basically the same thing, yeah, yeah. I was program director at a station in Spartanburg. I controlled what we played. We played Top 40. And if a record didn't fall in that category, in my judgment, we didn't play. Of course, I would get arguments from the disc jockeys. They wanted to play it for one reason or another. Maybe they liked it. Maybe they thought it would be a hit. Whatever. But, yeah, we had the same thing.
We've heard a lot about Plugola and Payola back in the 50s. Did you have any encounters with that?
Well, only to the extent that I got a cigarette lighter from Capitol Records.
Nobody showed up on the doorstep at your radio station and said, here's $50, please play this song?
I can't say that ever happened. I can say that we broke a big hit record, the Conway Twitty's first hit, Make Believe.
Wow.
We called him Maverick. That was when the Maverick series was hot on television.
Mm-hmm.
So we called him Maverick. We didn't think anybody would buy a record by a fellow named Conway Twitty. I mean, that just didn't seem possible. So we called him Maverick. And the record stores were going crazy because people were calling in and asking for Maverick. Didn't have it. They didn't know what they were talking about. So we called MGM Records and told them that they had a hit on their hands with Conway Twitty. The A&R man said, well, you know, we're getting some sales out of Cleveland, but what do you mean? And I told him, I said, well, we called him Maverick and the record's going wild here in Tallahassee, Florida. So I don't know how they dealt with that, but somehow he became a big hit.
What about promotions at WTMA or WOKE in Charleston? Do you remember anything in specific that you all did?
We did the usual same kind of promotions that you all are doing now. Nothing has changed in that regard. We did some big promotions in Florida. We had some promotions at WOKE and TMA, too, but they were mostly simple contests. Nothing earth-shattering. Nothing
identify
like
this artist, call in and win,
yeah,
that kind of thing.
Yeah, same thing. Third caller to identify this artist is going to win a record album or two tickets to a movie or whatever it was. And I did a lot of that sort of thing at the drive-in restaurant, too. You know, you get a free chicken dinner if you recognize this artist, that kind of thing.
The WTMA was also simulcast on FM back in the 50s.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Did anybody listen on the FM, or was that pretty much ignored?
I don't think it was ignored as much as we thought back then. I really don't. I thought for years that it was. And then I later learned that maybe it wasn't as ignored as I thought.
Well, they simulcast until, I believe, the 70s when it became WPXI. And then later became 95SX, which it is today.
Well, see, by that time I was in television news, and my interest in the disc jockey side of the of radio had pretty much waned. So I lost track of all of that.
So how long were you at Channel 2?
Until 1978.
And then what'd you do after that?
Went to Washington, worked for...
D.C.?
Did Washington, D.C. Worked for a congressman for a couple of years, and then went to work for a management organization of federal employees. And I lobbied the Congress and what have you for the next 15 years. So I spent 15 years up there, and then I retired in 93.
So what are you doing nowadays?
Well, nowadays I'm doing some writing. Got two books in the hands of an agent in New York. And otherwise, I'm just diddle-piddling around trying to stay out of trouble. I used to chase women, but now I don't remember why. So I, you know.
Do you ever miss radio?
Yeah, I did a lot when I first left the disc jockey side of it. A disc jockey back then was a star. He was a star in a very small pond, but he was a star. I was a star when I was at the Target drive-in restaurant, you know what I'm saying? And it was a lot of fun. It was very exciting.
Do you remember how much money you were making back then?
Oh, gosh, no, I don't, but I wasn't making much. I can tell you that I went to work for WNCG in that news thing for $100 a week.
Wow.
$100 a week. But that was a special situation. They said, we'll gamble if you'll gamble. And I said, well, I will if you will. So that's really why. Now, that later improved. But I went to work for them for $100 a week.
So that wasn't very much money back then.
No, no, no. Sure wasn't. Took me years to get out of debt after that, too.
I bet it did.
Yeah.
So when you were chasing the news stories, you didn't say, you know, I could be at the drive-in right now playing music for 17-year-old girls.
Yeah, I did from time to time. but it was fun. It was all fun. Broadcasting was fun. It was the most fun time of my life, matter of fact. I had a good time in Washington, but broadcasting both as a disc jockey and as a radio newsman and as a television newsman was a lot of fun. Very exciting.
What was your favorite time in radio or broadcasting?
Probably WNCG. I want to say WTMA too, but WNCG by and large, because that was fun. I mean, I was creating something that didn't heretofore exist, starting something no one had ever done in Charleston, and so that was a huge challenge. I liked to work my butt off, but it was a lot of fun. It was very exciting, personally satisfying, too.
Did they replace you after you left?
Yeah, but it declined after that. I don't think it declined because I was so great. I think it might have declined because the passion was not there. I had the passion for it, so it would be unfair to suggest someone else wasn't as good. But I don't think anybody who followed me would have had the passion, because I was starting something new. I mean, you know, I was building something nobody had. I was very proud of it, too.